Movement has the biggest deals of the holiday season and the sleekest watches around, whether you're gifting for family, friends, or yourself. Shop 30 to 60% off Movement's variety of designs, colorways, and functionalities. From the thinnest automatic dress watch under $500 to waterproof guarantee adventure-ready sport watches to rare ceramics. Be the good gifter this year. Shop 30 to 60% off now at Movement.com and enjoy fast and free shipping. That's MVMT.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
I've been able to live my normal lifestyle, and I've lost 20 pounds already. Changed my life.
I wasn't expecting it to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
In the heart of these animated wonders, there are tales and symbols older and darker than the castle's highest tower. Welcome to Occult Disney. Journey with Paranoid American and Matthew Comegys as they traverse the intricate pathways of alchemy, the shadowed corners of biblical narratives, and the very folklore that birthed these tales. Beneath every brushstroke lie whispers of writers' taboos, the cloak and dagger politics of hallowed studios, and secrets held close. Every magic has its price, every kingdom its shadows. Are you prepared to peer beyond the veil? Welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast.
Hi, everyone. It is Occult Disney. This is Matt here. Joining me, as always, is the Paranoid American. Howdy.
Hey, guys.
There we go. Keep it nice and short and sweet. But it's Christmas time, isn't it? It's a holiday season. And it just happens to line up nicely that it is time on our list of movies to do The Nightmare Before Christmas, the ground zero for Hot Topic stores, at least for the 20 years afterwards. I don't know about now. I haven't been a Hot Topic for ever.
You don't have to lie.
No, I was just thinking, I think I never went to one because by the time they showed up in malls, I was in, you know, Athens, Georgia, and we had like the Junkman's daughter. Why would I go to Hot Topic?
So you've never been in a Hot Topic unironically?
I probably went in with a girlfriend at some point, just kind of walked in for a minute. Yeah, but I don't think I've ever bought anything at a Hot Topic. But I did notice that half of the things there, at least in like the 2000s, were, you know, from The Nightmare Before Christmas or new metal bands, right? So
I will admit, I think I bought a clearance like Marilyn Manson shirt from a Hot Topic while I was in high school. So it fits the bill.
That makes sense. Maybe you didn't have a Junkman's daughter or a Junkman's daughter's brother.
I don't even know what you're talking about, and it sounds like it might even be illegal.
It does when you say it that way. No, those are some kind of boutique-y, weird, young hipster stores in Atlanta area and Athens, Georgia. So maybe they're still there. I couldn't say. But yeah, that I guess that all of this stuff, you know, kind of like keys into my mind. Goth girls, high school, like you're saying. For me, that kind of is The Nightmare Before Christmas.
I mean, you could just extend that to Tim Burton, couldn't you?
You could, but especially this one, like, you know, Batman Returns or Ed Wood, the movies he was actually making when this was being made, don't have that. Great movies, but don't really have that same cachet, you know?
I don't know. I think Edward Scissorhands might have been one of those OG. He's kind of like a cooler version of the guy from The Cure. And I can't believe I can't remember his name right off the top of my
Robert
head.
Smith.
Yeah, he's kind of like an even edgier, pun intended, version of Robert Smith in a way. But that became this new like love interest. Like, I love the dead guy. I love the homunculus. Because that's, let's be honest, that's what Edward Scissorhands was. He was a homunculus.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense when you say it that way. I did say Ed Wood, by the way, which is a different flavor.
But, no, I understand it. Yeah, Ed Wood didn't really get the same attention as the other ones, but it was also more of a sleeper. Like, you had to care a little bit about Ed Wood. It's also a really interesting one.
I did. I saw it opening night. I'm just saying, I think it's funny that he made some
hardcore
Ed movies, you know? The other thing about The Nightmare Before Christmas is I saw it opening night. And I watched it last night. That was my second viewing. I haven't not seen it since October 29th, 1993. So,
bro, this is a pretty consistent classic here. And we'll get into, I guess, one of my main theories here. I'll just blurt it out, whatever. But that Disney is, and this isn't like, I'm not uncovering like these golden plates and deciphering them and claiming a new religion out of this. It's almost a completely obvious, but just to state the obvious, Disney decided, why don't we just own the entire months from October to December? If we take this particular strategy and release this movie, which came out on October 29th, so it came out like right at October during Halloween, and like it has this longevity that can last all the way through Christmas. So now people collect it for not just Halloween, but also for Christmas. And by establishing that, it almost made it like an evergreen thing, because if it can apply to two holidays, why can't it just apply year round and become more of like a mentality? And I think that was I don't know if they did it intentionally. It feels like they did it intentionally, but they definitely know how to market it intentionally.
Yeah, I think it's the marketing, some lucky serendipity, because this is a little bit outside of the Disney sphere. Tim Burton, of course, we've mentioned before, was an animator with Disney in the early 80s. He did the first version of Frankenweenie. He did Vincent. He wanted to do this as like a 30-minute special or something, but then he left Disney, became a successful director, Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the Batman movies, and realized that Disney owed him like a film project or something. So, and Katzenberg was into the idea of him doing it. Of course, like I said, Burton was actually making Batman Returns and then Ed Wood when this was in production. So this is technically like a Harry Selleck movie, and they've branded it with Tim Burton. So it's his story. It's his ideas. It's his sensibility. Selleck was partly tasked with, make it a Tim Burton movie. But apparently Tim Burton was only in the San Francisco production studio like maybe 8 or 10 days for the whole production. So he was not very hands-on, but they were, you know, it was kind of like he was franchising his aesthetic.
And pretty smart. And honestly, sometimes if you find a team that understands the vision, you don't have to be there every day, and that might even be good, right? Like, you might not have to micromanage any of it, and they might be able to do a better job.
And stop motion animation literally drives people insane, so I can see him being like, yeah, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of stop motion animation, like even more than regular animation.
Yeah, I got these Hot Topic shirts to sell. I can't go crazy quite yet.
Right, I already look crazy, can't go crazy. Of course, we got Danny Elfman here. Which, have you seen any modern pictures of Danny Elfman?
You mean like a photograph of Danny Elfman? I have not.
Yeah. Oh, he's been doing concerts recently. He's like in his 60s or something, maybe up to 70. And
is he a looker?
He's something to look at. He's always got wildly dyed hair. He's gotten jacked, which is insane. Like he's like been bodybuilding or something. So when you see him now, you're kind of like, what is this?
Right on, man. I mean,
good for him, but he's definitely like, he's chosen especially in later years, he's chosen an even stronger visual vibe than a personal visual vibe than Tim Burton.
He picked it up a little late in life, but it's never too long to peacock your way out.
Well, it was weird from the start. He was in the, started off in the band Oingo Boingo. You know, which I was wondering if that's why it's Oogie Boogie in this movie. So, but
who is legitimately creepy as a villain, in my opinion?
Yeah, yeah, it looks a little bit like somewhere between the Ghostbuster symbol and when they tried to turn the Ghostbuster symbol into a CGI monster in the 2016 movie. Kind of made me think of that a little bit. This is cooler because it's got the texture and the bugs inside and stuff. So,
and I think there's just something inherently scary about a burlap sack to a child. Like, you're a kid, you see a burlap sack, you're like, something good's not coming out of this thing.
That could be it. Yeah, there is something about the psychic influence of this movie, because I'm like, who did I even see this movie with? I might have just gone with my dad, but of course in my mind now I went with like goth girls, but I don't think I actually went to the movies with the goth girls. We just had a quote unquote lunch, as in we weren't eating anything out in front of the school. That's how dumb a kid I was. I was like, I don't want to be in a lunchroom. I'll just hang out in front of the school. And then girls started hanging out with me, and like, I didn't put two and two together there, but that's my own problem as a teenager.
Yeah, it clicks like 10 years later, and you're like, oh, that's what was going on.
Oops. Oh, well.
So this was, I think this came out around the same time, too, that I wasn't like, it was not cool to go to the movies with your parents at this point. Even though I don't agree with that now, I don't believe that now. At the time, I 100% believed it. It was like, if people even knew you lived in the same house as your parents, you might not be as cool as you really could be. Like, you know, I live by myself. I've got my own apartment. Maybe not to that extreme. But I think because of that, I saw this thing on DVD when it came out and like the background when I wasn't paying as much attention. But after I caught a glimpse of it, I did end up going and like renting it and just like watched it. And I thought it was cool. I mean, like you said, it was a complete departure from what Disney's been doing up until now. The closest I can even think of would be maybe Fantasia, when they do the whole, you know, black god scene. I can't think of a lot of other like overly creepy, like completely focused on just creepiness for the entire movie situations in any other Disney movie.
Yeah, this one was released under Touchstone, like Roger Rabbit, because they're like, oh, it's a little more adult, so we should not market it to kids. But about,
they've embraced it though. Later, like, they have fully embraced it at this point, as if it were
rebranded.
Disney.
Yes, it's been rebranded as like a mainline Disney film. When I was looking at the Blu-ray here, I got, you know, the new CGI logo, which I wanted a Touchstone logo, so I was a little disappointed there. It's always fun to see the old Touchstone logo here and there, or even the, you know, the weird synth themed white and blue logo from the 90s. I missed that one. So I yeah, leave the period appropriate logo on your movie, people.
I don't think they're listening.
No, they're not listening.
Anyone that would actually hear that could do something about it isn't hearing it.
The other fun thing is I had to rewatch the last 20 minutes of the movie actually just before doing this, because, you know, not because it was boring or something, it was short. I remember on opening night us being a little disappointed because it was so short. We were like, what, that was it? But yeah, last night I was like dozing off a little, so I had to rewrite it, but I kept writing notes while I was like falling asleep. So I'll read a few of those because I don't know what they mean. I said something looks like a scientific bong. I don't know what that means.
The guy kind of does, the scientist does.
That might be it. Okay. Santa's OCD with all of his lists. Well, that's the list. Here's the one. They've got something for Peyton Reese's military organization. Like, what does that mean?
It was just like an infomercial that came on in the middle of the night. You're like, I should look into that.
I don't know, but that's the one that really blows my mind. But the point is, I was watching this like in a weird between state and writing strange things in my notes. So I was kind of excited about that, but I did have to rewatch the last 20 minutes of the movie this morning. So,
well, since you went on a tangent, I'm going to cash in a tangent card really quick. Are there any weird, like, and I don't even know if you still even have like network TV, but let's just say you had, you know, regular network TV, or if it were 10 years ago, are there weird infomercials in Japan too about like stuff that would only be on at 2 a.m. or is like it just weird 24/7?
Oh, it's weird 24/7. 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning, you'll come on and there's a panel of TV talent. What is their talent? They're on TV panels. That's like all they do. And they're like all like oh, it's a guy over like a, you know, an electric toothbrush or something. So it's not just 2 a.m. It's like, you know, all day, every day.
It sounds like pre-TikTok. Like you're just good at being excited and having facial expressions.
It is. Like, people still watch network TV in Japan, which is a different beast in Japan, of course. But, you know, especially older people just watch whatever's on TV. And even kids are watching TV. I can't think of American kids like watching proper TV much anymore. So,
yeah, I think it would be weird. I mean, not that it's like would be bad, because I assume if you're like homeschooled or if you don't let your kids have their own devices that consume media, you might be watching network TV, or you've got a stack of Disney movies, or maybe just like VeggieTales if Disney's too evil.
Another interesting thing is NHK, the state TV, Japanese state TV, which people do watch. It's not like PBS in the States. But Sunday night, they will feature like an American or British movie or something. And then that like validates the Japanese people and thinking, oh, that must be a good movie. Like, so there, that's a like kind of weird, subtle or not so subtle mind control.
Do you know any of the movies they've played recently?
Whiplash.
Okay, so fairly modern. Yeah, the drummer movie, right?
Yeah, which was called Sessions in Japan, which I haven't seen yet. I do my film podcast. It's on the list. I'm like, I'll watch it when we get there, you know? But I've had a friend tell me, I think he saw it on the NHK and just like, you should watch it. It's great. And yeah, it's supposed to be a very good movie, but that's the one I can think of. What are some other ones? I think maybe the Star Wars prequels became more popular in Japan that way, because in Japan, people like the prequels, maybe because since it's dubbed, they got better voice actors.
Is it a burn?
It's a,
yeah, taking a shots right now.
Yeah. Well, I'm just like, if you have a voice actors, they're kind of, you know, because the prequels, even with very good actors, are giving you very stilted lines. So if you have someone dub it, then you're doing okay.
I personally liked the George Lucas Star Wars the best out of all of them so far. I mean the two, what is it, the 1999 one? I don't even know the name of it.
The Phantom Menace.
That's my favorite Star Wars to date still. And oh, I'll wow. die on that okay. hill.
But yeah, you said
followed by the Ewoks like, one, which was Return of the Jedi, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, yes.
Which are, as I also understand, are like the two worst ones when it comes to hardcore Star Trek or Star Wars lovers.
I guess. I don't know. Yeah. But it's also an age thing, I guess. But it's funny. Sometimes they'll have vintage stuff in the Japanese theaters. You will see Nightmare Before Christmas stuff regularly. They had like Phantom Menace action figures like 6 months ago at the little movie theater gift shop. So that was weird.
How was Nightmare Before Christmas play out in Japan?
It's a style thing only, I would say. I mean, I'm sure a few people have watched it, but people definitely know the imagery from the movie. But that's the thing in Japan. Like, I'll often see kids wearing like a Ramones t-shirt or something. That's because the design's cool. Or, you know, Stanley Kubrick movies t-shirts, and they got it at the Uniqlo, but they don't actually know what it is.
They got it at the Hot Topic or whatever the version of Hot Topic is, right?
Right. Well, that's half the stores in Tokyo, I guess. But
do you stop them? Like, name three Kubrick movies right now.
No, if they're wearing a 2001 shirt, it's like, have you seen that movie? And they're like, oh, this is a movie. Like, they don't even necessarily know it's a movie. So,
what about Santa Claus? Does he have any presents whatsoever?
Yeah, Christmas is basically like, kids get a present. Everybody is supposed to eat fried chicken. KFC did marketing so well 20 years back that everyone thinks they have to eat fried chicken for Christmas in Japan now. So when I tell them, like, we don't eat fried chicken in America so much for Christmas, that's, you know, they're like, what? It blows their mind.
That's honestly awesome. We should just do like an episode on how KFC managed to establish their foothold in Japanese Christmas.
Oh, and in the past year or two, they've started putting into commercials a young Japanese Colonel Sanders. So he's in the Colonel Sanders suit. He's got the goatee, but he looks like he's about 30. He doesn't look that old, you know? So
I think he could do well, man. He could be big in Japan.
He is big in Japan. They should market him in America just to really confuse people. Halloween here is interesting, actually, because Halloween only became a thing in the past 10 years. When I first started working in Japan, I'm working at an English school. We'd have a Halloween party, And I had a hell of a time finding a costume because it just what Halloween wasn't a thing here. It is now. Not so much like trick or treating, but Halloween parties. You know, kids are a little more into it. But what is Halloween music? I guess there's the Monster Mash, and there's This Is Halloween from this movie. So Halloween, October in Japan, you get just pelted over the brain the entire month with the song This Is Halloween. And then for Christmas, they hardcore Last Christmas. So in Japan, those are the ones you hear the most. This Is Halloween and Last Christmas.
That's a great note because, yeah, when you say Halloween music, I think Monster Mash, which is what, like 60s?
And yeah, they don't play that here.
Not a lot since then. There's like the Dr. Demento one. I can't remember what that one was, but that was a little bit more obscure. And then there's this song. So again, Disney, they found a gap in the market and they're like, we can really, and I guess this will go into my Disney theory, but like they own nostalgia. They've invested in the ultimate Bitcoin, which is nostalgia. And it means it's like the ultimate brand loyalty, essentially. And this is just a way to like solidify you thinking of Disney 24/7, or when Halloween pops up, now there's a reason for you to think of Disney again and keep thinking of Disney all the way through Christmas.
Although it wasn't this viewing when I figured out that that was the Nightmare Before Christmas song, but I've been hearing that song for the past 5 years and I haven't seen this movie for a while. So for the first 2 years of that, I'm like, what is this song? Cool. That they're just
Disney. If someone told you it's a Disney song, how surprised would you have been?
Yeah, there's a kind of this crazy like discount store, and it's not like a Walmart. It's like it's almost like mixing a Hot Topic with a Walmart, if that makes any sense. Called a Don Quixote, where they just have like super cheap stuff. When my parents visited a few years ago, my mom really liked it. So when they visited this October, I took them there because then they needed some things. But yeah, my mom was going nuts because they were playing that song at top volume. And she was like, I can't think, get me out of here. So Disney was melting her brain and she had to get out of there like just a few months ago.
It's worldwide, man. The programming is worldwide.
Yeah, yeah. That's at least like an amusing outcome of it. Well, not for her. I guess she was being driven nuts by the loud music and flashing lights in the discount store.
Maybe so what was your
all of us.
What was your takeaway opinion on your second viewing ever, aside from it putting you to sleep, apparently?
Well, that's because I was watching it late at night, not because I was like bored or didn't like it. I'm like trying to stay awake. That's where I started writing like bizarre notes, because I'm trying to stay awake and not quite managing it. And I woke up this morning, it's like, you know what? I didn't actually know what happened in the last 20 minutes of that. But that did let me watch the Oogie Boogie sequence in like kind of a dream state, I guess. So watching this morning, I could make sense out. And last night, like, what was that? What happened, man? You know, that sort of thing. So
there was like black lights. Whoa, what's going on?
It was kind of like I watched the last 20, 30 minutes of it like on acid or something last night. So that's kind of cool. The sleepy version, but whatever. Homegrown. Maybe the DMT in my brain was just like pulsing a bit. I don't know. So that made it kind of cool. But yeah, I guess now it has a reputation. So when we first saw it, it was like, wow, that animation is so cool. Not really understanding even what goes into stop motion like I do now. So now I'm just like sitting there like trying to figure out how they did half of this stuff. So that's kind of cool. The story, you know, knowing more about archetypes and knowing more about like relationships and stuff, it worked better. I don't know. When I first saw it, something, the story didn't latch me for some reason. So maybe it wasn't for kids. What would I have been 14 when I saw it? So I don't know. But yeah, you know, I quite enjoyed watching it last night. So I'm not the biggest person in, like, I like a lot of Tim Burton movies, but the Tim Burton aesthetic has never really been like my thing. So, so there's a weird rambling answer to your question.
I mean, I definitely think Tim Burton's aesthetic was my thing. Although Edward Scissorhands by far is like, for me, that's like peak Tim Burton aesthetic. And after that, it kind of just gets ridiculous. Then you get like Willy Wonka, which is almost like the lip injection BBL version of Tim Burton in a way. You know, it's got like this artificial gleam to it where everything's just inflated a little bit, but yeah, is that making me like a Tim Burton hipster?
Maybe I'm at my most Burton-y now because I wear dark suits a lot. I don't know. I usually wear black, you know, dark jacket, dark shirt if I can. So, no, what would have been my aesthetics? You know, I was playing in bands in high school. So in early 90s, just straight grunge, you know, flannel shirt and band t-shirt and jeans, which I don't wear jeans anymore. And then in the late 90s, I actually did this several times where I would play concerts dressed basically like Kraftwerk on the Man Machine cover, skinny black tie and a red shirt thing. I did that for a few years. Then when I went to university, I went with early fedora and, like, you know, I was trying to look like a Jack Kerouac in the 50s, I guess, for a while. So that's always been like my style choices.
Did you ever tip your hat and call someone m'lady?
No, I don't think I did any hat tipping. It was like an Indiana Jones fedora. It wasn't like a classic.
Okay. And it still doesn't get a pass, by the way, if you're wondering. It doesn't get a pass. Like the intent doesn't matter.
1997.
Even in 97, it doesn't count. It's like possession is 9/10 of the law. If you had a fedora, you're guilty.
I did. So by 2003, 2004, I was like, maybe I shouldn't wear this thing. But I still have, like, there you go. I still have that. So. I don't wear this one. I just got this one because it was like two hats 50% off.
But you're 40s now, right?
Yeah. Okay.
You're allowed to wear fedoras now because they're made for old men.
Okay. I will be rocking the Santa cap next week, I guess, because I'll be doing Christmas all week at the school. So maybe I should sing "This Is Halloween." I don't know.
You could do the Jack Skellington version.
Something like that. I couldn't hit those notes. I can sing okay, but you do have to give Danny Elfman credit for being able to hit all those notes since he does Jack's singing voice. I did notice Catherine O'Hara, it seems, did the voice of Sally and the singing as well. So I guess she could actually sing. Are you very familiar with Catherine O'Hara?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't know why.
She's the mom in Home Alone. I think she might be in Schitt's Creek more recently.
Okay, yeah.
The best name titles. And I'm just a massive SCTV fan, so of course she was on SCTV.
Also Beetlejuice.
Oh, yeah, she's the lead in Beetlejuice, yeah. But yeah, for me, it's always like that one of the SCTV people, so because that television show has always been one of my weird obsessions. Even
What's
now,
SCTV?
Like SCTV? It was a Canadian sketch comedy show from the late 70s, early 80s. Had Eugene Levy, Joe Flatterly, John Candy, Rick Moranis, Martin Short were all on it. Harold Ramis was on it for a while. He was a head writer.
Canadian Saturday Night Live or what?
Yeah, but it's not like a stage or anything. It's set up to look like you're just watching this network. So it's like fake commercials, fake TV shows. And one of the it takes a little while to get into it because there are almost no punchlines. Everything is played like almost like 100% straight. So it's just, you have to get in the vibe that they're subverting what you expect from television. So it's really funny, but there are no punchlines, and that's off-putting for a lot of people. But you can watch a bunch of it on YouTube. I would, if you go for the first couple seasons, it's like 30 minute episodes or something. Bob and Doug McKenzie, the Canadian beer swillers, come from that show. If you've ever seen the movie Strange Brew. Have you seen the movie Strange Brew?
I know I have, but I can't even place what the hell it was about.
Oh, that's about using beer to with chemicals to mind control people, so then they can be triggered by basically a Moog. We were talking about Moogs earlier. So you'll see all the employees of the brewery, someone's in there like, and they go run and put in these like stormtrooper hockey suits and they like force them to play hockey or something.
on top of a gas station?
No, in a hockey rink in the brewery. They have a hockey rink in the brewery. So
as you do.
That's right. But yeah, actually, I would highly recommend having a look at least at the wiki for Strange Brew, because that does have some interesting, you know, mind control MK Ultra vibe stuff in it. So what do you think this movie is trying to get across on more subtle levels? We can't, like you said, Disney aced the marketing as hard as they could, but the construction of the movie is from different sources. Apparently Disney did not meddle that much in this one. This is, you know, Burton's orders and Selleck making and his team making it. for the most part. So
I was wondering how much of this is autobiographical for Tim Burton, because to me, it almost seems like Jack is living in this scientific world, and it's basically atheism. He's living inside atheism, where the world is dead, there's no life anywhere, and everyone's obsessed with the scientific method and everything, like having to equal something. And even Jack, when he first discovers Christmas, he goes back and he's trying to like make potions, and he's writing out math equations, and he's trying to figure out like what's the logic and what's the math and what's the science behind all of this. And there's a lot of references to science in general. And I guess Chris, in this way, it's like Christmas kind of represents just religion as a whole in a way to Disney, where it's like Jack just found religion and he doesn't understand what it is yet, because it's a feeling, not necessarily something that he can write down on a board or explain that exists in this world of like dead, like the Halloween world that he lives in. So that, it's, to me, that's what the real story is about Jack discovering religion or like some kind of a higher power and not being able to come to terms with it. And to me, that feels like something that Tim Burton probably went through as a kid, maybe. And so that would make it biographical, but I'm reading into that deeply because it's what we do here.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the shot that sticks with me, and I didn't remember it. I mean, it's been, you know, 30 years since I watched it last time, but the scene where he is looking at all of the holiday doors and the trees, for me, that really stuck in my mind. And he just happened to choose, well, the picture of a tree on a tree. So he could have gone with a turkey on a tree too, but I'm glad he didn't, because that movie would have been dry and tough, I think. So
I don't know, that I had that same exact thought, because when he gets to that scene, he gets into the middle of the woods, and this is a great way for, I'm surprised that they haven't revisited this yet. Maybe they have and I just don't know about.
There's been attempts at sequels and prequels, and none of them have ever really taken.
But so. There's a St. Patrick's Day tree, there's an Easter tree, there's a Valentine's tree, there's the turkey tree that represents Thanksgiving. And I was trying to think, there's not a lot of kids Thanksgiving movies that like blew up. The only one I can really think of would be like Adam's Family 2, because they go to camp and there's the big you know what I mean? But there's another gap in the market.
That's exactly the example I was going to spit out too. So
clearly there's a gap in the market here, because if someone says Christmas movie, you can think of a bunch. Someone says Halloween movie, you can like nonstop, you know, options. Valentine's Day movie, same thing. Thanksgiving movie, I don't know, man. I don't think anyone's really fully owned like the Thanksgiving cinema sort of go-to.
I would... probably isn't Planes, Trains, and Automobiles Thanksgiving. I think that one is, but that's not really a good one for kids.
Yeah, maybe, but it's also very dated. I mean, isn't that from like the early 80s or the mid 80s?
Late 80s,
like,
but yeah.
So yeah, 40-year-old movie. That's what I'm saying, is that nobody has really owned that in quite a while. Does nobody Chicken want Run? Thanksgiving? It seems like someone's leaving money on the table here.
I don't. Well, you know what? I've lived in a world with no Thanksgiving now for quite a long time, and that's fine with me. I know. Yeah, Thanksgiving, the only thing I was excited about was, you know, going to see a movie at night, because Thanksgiving, it's like, it's going to be everything's closed. We're eating food. I don't really
but
like
there's
that
no
much.
Thanksgiving movies.
People
right?
want to watch football, but there's movies opening on Thanksgiving. You can go see the new James Bond.
Right. But I don't know. Maybe this is some jumps following a thread too deep, but I feel like there could be an awesome Thanksgiving movie out there.
Oh, there could be. Yeah. So that is a mountain to climb. I'm sitting here thinking, man, could I make that entertaining? I don't know.
It would have to be like a horror. For me, it would have to be a horror movie.
Oh, there's got to be a Thanksgiving horror movie.
There's lots of them. They just aren't always, great.
I always love it when people take like a somewhat obscure holiday and, you know, make a joke. When there's a from about 10 years ago, featuring Tim Allen as a trailer for Arbor Day, where, you know, dad's too busy and stuff for his son, and then he gets turned into a tree.
Like a Rob Schneider movie.
Well, it's the trailer has Tim Allen, actually. So yeah, it's worth, I think it's on his YouTube page. You couldn't watch it. Arbor Day.
I do think this is genius, though, because Disney could at any point go back and do a Jack Skellington Easter movie or a Jack Skellington Thanksgiving movie, I would vote. I mean, for taking votes, I would vote Jack Skellington Thanksgiving movie. But well, like, because now you could span Jack Skellington and apply him to even more holidays.
I was going to say, Jack gets the Haunted Mansion every, from October to December, pretty much every year now, I believe. I'm not sure if that's true in all parks. It's definitely true in the Tokyo one. So, and I kind of assume that the American ones do that too.
How much weight can Jack carry? Can, do you think Jack could carry another holiday on his back? Or do you think that he's kind of loaded up with Halloween and Christmas pretty well?
Well, he just dabbled in Christmas. He could do New Year, I guess. He had another old man and a baby to contend with. So that would be like a sequel edition. Oh, it's not just, you know, old man time, but it's the baby New Year as well. So he's got two critters to deal with. The Easter Bunny, they kind of like dispatched the Easter Bunny really quick in this movie, I guess. So 4th of July, Uncle Sam, another old man. I guess we just need to you know, pair Jack Skellington with old white men with white beards.
Or again, since they dispose of the Easter Bunny pretty quick, this, the world of Jack Skellington could also, if it's not this relationship between atheism and religion, it could be like the non-psychedelic experience versus the psychedelic, because I still firmly believe, no one has pushed me off, that Santa is a mushroom, that Easter Bunny is a mushroom, the Easter eggs are mushrooms. I really do believe this. The Holy Grail is a freaking mushroom. So here's Jack Skellington in a world of black and white monotony. Everything's the same all the time. And then he gets this glimpse of a completely different world filled with color. And he goes through all of the symbolism of Santa as a shaman, right? He's got, they talk about the socks being hung up, and he notes that they don't have feet in them. And sometimes they've got like little goodies. He notices like the whole tree, the presents, like he brings back all the symbolism that is specific to mushrooms and Santa being a shaman, essentially the Amanita muscaria, I believe, like in particular. So I feel like that could be another really thing that overlays on top of this movie, is that Jack got his first like big hit of something, and he doesn't know how to explain it, which is, you know, the biggest problem when someone has their first spiritual or other dimensional thing, like you don't necessarily know how to write it down or explain it to another person. So what does he do? He goes out and he brings mushrooms back for everyone. In this case, he brings Santa back for everybody to take, you know, partake in it.
So Oogie Boogie ate too many mushrooms, that we're getting at. He's driven himself insane. He didn't stay on the middle path well enough.
Maybe, because yeah, they bring the kids bring Santa to Oogie Boogie first, right? So he was gonna like try and take a heroic dose, but he wasn't prepared for it.
He was no McKenna, okay.
No, he was no McKenna, my friend.
Yeah.
And I got a quick question just before I forget it. Is this a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie?
Oh, that's always been the thing here. It's like you said, it's both. You get to own both holidays.
Right, but if you had to pin it to one, what is it?
Well, it is the calendar that we've been doing these movies on, but I'm clearly pinning it as a Christmas movie this year. So
I agree. I think this is more Christmas than Halloween.
But if we had started this podcast 2 months earlier, then for us it would have been a Halloween movie. But that's just because of scheduling. So I think Christmas more. It's marketing again. I think that the Haunted Mansion is going to do its holiday overlay. And when you say holiday in that way, you mean Christmas. So that's cemented this in my mind as a Christmas movie. Before that, I might have said Halloween, but now at first, you know, Haunted Mansion, Christmas theming. Yes.
I think that once you've got a Santa hat in a movie, it's a Christmas movie more than anything else.
Oh yeah, it's always fun. I mean, you know, there's always Die Hard's my favorite Christmas movie. You know, Iron Man 3 is a Christmas movie. That's the interesting thing about Shane Black, the guy who directed that. All of his movies are secretly Christmas movies. I guess he just is really into Christmas.
I think it's genius.
Christmas movie.
I really do, and I know how simple minded it is, but I think it would be genius to sneak in a reason to have a Christmas tree or a Christmas hat in every movie you ever make, just so that you can get it on Christmas playlists. Like it. It really does qualify as a Christmas movie. As far as I'm concerned, if you check it with me, it counts.
Yeah, in 2023, I'm going to put a hard yes on this being a Christmas movie. But If you did want to watch it at Halloween, I can get that too.
It's simple math. Tim Horton's 2-3-4 menu fills your mornings without emptying your pockets. $2 gets you a hot coffee or a classic bagel. $3, try a sausage and cheese English muffin or two classic donuts. And for $4, enjoy an egg and cheese croissant or an iced cap. Do the math. It all adds up to delicious deals. Only at Tim's. The Tim's 2-3-4 menu is available until 2 p.m. at select Columbus, Ohio restaurants. Terms apply.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now, during our Black Friday sale, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. Plus special financing. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
Some people probably do both.
So, and Jack also in this movie at the very beginning, because I'm rewatching this for the first time, caring about what's happening instead of just the visual eye candy. Mm. And I noticed right away that he is the Wicker Man. He's the Burning Man at the very beginning of their Halloween ritual. So they, like, he's literally covered in, you know, bales of hay or wheat or grass. And they burn him, like he's on fire and he's dancing around. And this is the big night. Like this is them expelling all of their cares. He's the cremation of care ritual, essentially, just with a pumpkin on his head instead of anything else. And the rest, as soon as that ends, the rest of the town, all they care about is planning for the next Halloween, like for the next 364 days. That's all they care about. So to me, this is a very real imagery of Jack being the Wicker Man, the Burning Man, that whole pagan concept of, you know, burning your cares away in this symbolic magic way, which is kind of weird because the rest of everything that they really discuss feels like it's very scientific and everyone's trying to prove things and everyone's trying to figure out like the logic and the ration. And that's what sets Jack apart and Sally, because Jack's the only one that has a feeling about something, and then Sally, she has a vision and she has the same feeling, and no one else seems to have that kind of insight, like any sort of empathy.
So a lot of the techies would have been, you know, teenagers or even younger or a little older. And do you think this is a seed? Because this sets a lot of kind of style choices, especially in the 90s, you know, 10 or so years later, the tech folks start going out into the desert for Burning Man, trying to have this kind of a bacchanal. I don't know.
I think the Burning Man is a bigger influence than anything else that's been adapted to it. So like, yeah. And when I say Burning Man, I mean the original Burning Man, not the one that's out in the desert, but like that original Wicker Man concept.
I'm getting that. I was going to say, you know, Christopher Lee would have loved this guy, because I want to make sure we're tying that into the 1973 Wicker Man.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you might as well just say Christopher Lee Burning Man is the same exact movie as Nightmare Before Christmas. That there's not a single frame difference between the two.
Although it is interesting. Yeah, not a single frame. You know, they got the constable, and that is driven to terror, whereas in the Nightmare Before Christmas, it's Santa that's driven to terror. The constable's going into the situation, not knowing what it is, but walking willingly into the situation for reasons that he doesn't know. Santa is being kidnapped here. So that's kind of a different thing. The level of terror is a little different, because it's Wicker Man, the movie, I'm specifically saying the good one, is what have I done? I walked into this. Where Santa just gets to be creeped out by Halloween world and, you know, like accosted by Oogie Boogie.
Yeah, although he's not the one that gets sacrificed. He does get kidnapped, but it's for a slightly different reason than Wicker Man, because in this concept, it's Jack Skellington that burns and represents that Wicker Man. But if you think about it, his original plan is, I'm going to bring Santa here, and then I'm going to go and become Santa. We're going to swap places. So if Jack Skellington is used to being the Wicker Man every year and he's tired of it, he goes out and he turns Santa into the Wicker Man in this case. So yeah, Santa didn't necessarily ask for it, but he's now in the exact same place as the Wicker Man would be. And in theory, if Santa performed Jack Skellington's role, he would be set on fire.
So if Santa had been down with the plan, could you accept a holly jolly Halloween?
Well, Wicker Man doesn't necessarily represent Halloween, right? Isn't that a summer solstice ritual?
Oh, I'm just assuming that if Jack is taking Christmas, then Santa has to take out, you know, it's only fair.
I mean, if it just means more presents for everyone, maybe.
Well, you get presents like Jack's giving the kids, I guess. I don't know. Another favorite shot is the kid just nonchalantly holding the shrunken head. That's fantastic, because all the other kids are being attacked by their creepy presents or flipping out at their creepy present. That's because it's like,
and it looks so much like the shrunken head in the Beetlejuice movie again.
Yeah, maybe they just borrowed it from there.
It's the Tim Burton version of a hidden Mickey, as he just sneaks a shrunken head into all of his movies.
Well, I do the podcast where I look through all the Twilight Zone episodes and the sci-fi, the space ones in particular. It's just funny because like half the props in all of those episodes are from Forbidden Planet. So, you know, they literally just went to the closet and got these Forbidden Planet props and used them. So could be like that, or, you know. We'll get to in the Pixars, where every Pixar movie has something in it to suggest the next Pixar movie. Like, you'll see a Lotso Bear on the wall somewhere in Up, I think, that sort of thing.
Yeah, when we speculated that might have started with the Brave Little Toaster, and that the lamp might be the lamp in the Pixar logo.
Yes, yes, yes. So we'll get back to that line soon enough, I imagine. Did we hit your notes directly?
I've got one last note, and this kind of backs up the theory that it might be about atheism and finding religion, or maybe some kind of a spiritual experience of some kind. But Santa, as they first kind of interact, and he says, "Haven't you heard of heaven on earth and goodwill towards men?" And then Jack just nonchalantly, just like, "Nope," and then he just keeps going right along.
That was Lock, Stock, and
The Boogie Boys.
Yeah.
The Boogie Boys also representing this like scientific method way of thinking. Like there's no room for spiritualism, right? It's all logic. And that's when he's like, "No, wait, I don't fit in there." And they're like, "You fit through a chimney, so you'll fit through here." And I thought that was another really good way of just showing like their scientific way of rationale, right? They logically thought out, oh, this property applies to you in this way, so it should apply to you in this way. So again, like they're very scientifically minded, and it keeps coming up. The mad scientist, even Jack mentions the word science a few times and how he's like thinking about the world. So all that is making a really strong case.
And then the Dr. Seussie land. I was going to mention, because when he goes to Christmastown, it is like the psychedelic trip. It's very Whoville, that kind of thing. The real world is made to look pretty much in between and somewhat bland. It's kind of like intentionally bland in this movie. Like the houses are very suburban, which, you know, Tim Burton loves to do. Again, look at Edward Scissorhands again. So he's going to this. Is he trying to bring magic to a very unmagical place? He's been bringing dark magic, which, you know, if you wanted to get weird and fire and brimstone religion, you could also say that's science. If you wanted, science is dark magic, and he's opposed to the brightness, but then he's trying to bring whatever to our real world, made somewhat bland in this movie. Kind of animation's great. I'm just talking design.
Right, and you can even see when it goes between the different worlds that when he's in like Christmas Town, it's colorful, it's saturated, it's what you probably would expect like a Disney movie to look like in a lot of ways. And then when he goes back to his town, it's very much more like sepia toned, it's cooler colors. Like obviously there's color treatment for the obvious reasons, but they like crank it over a little bit. And then once they go to the suburban town in the regular world, it's got more than just a neutral effect. They almost like suck some of the saturation out to make it seem a little bit more lifeless than either Jack Skellington's world or the Christmas world.
Yeah, when they're trying to shoot down his coffin, you know, the shots of the infantry, not infantry, the artillery is just very like, it looks like, you know, World War II stock footage sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a story here where Tim Burton is talking about the weaponization of Christmas in a way, because there's also, you know, the fact that Santa's normally coming here and he kind of paints Santa being like an idiot and everyone in Christmas Town being idiots, and that everyone that lives with Jack Skellington, like, they're kind of more advanced, they're smarter. Again, they're like the scientific mad scientists.
Yeah, but insane. Don't fit in.
But insane, but wouldn't you rather be smart and insane? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a good question. Smart and insane or dumb and happy?
Yeah, well, I guess we get to a bit to Sally and her creator, because Sally is our shrinking Violet, who is literally stitched together, able to separate her parts and remain, and those parts can remain like sentient in some way. A Brave Little Toaster we talked about. We'll talk a little more in Tori's story, but I thought it was interesting. I had to think about that here a little bit too. Daddy splits his brain with his new creation, you know, nice and ghoulish for the animation. But when you think about it, it's like, okay, that's kind of a wild trip.
Is this AI? Is that him uploading? And does that mean that the scientist is catfishing Jack Skellington? Like, is there even really a Sally?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but in the case of his new creation, he literally pulls out half of his brain and puts in a new one, where you don't get the impression he did that with Sally. Sally is Sally, kind of a homunculus as well, being created. Well,
absolutely she is.
Yeah. And how many of these creations are? Is Lock and Shock the same thing? Where did the doctor come from? I mean, I'm getting a little chicken and the egg here, I guess, but... you know, how many of these are actual beings and how many of them are like magical or scientific creations?
So I would argue that Sally is something different, like if not a homunculus, something more magical, because it directly violates the René Descartes' whole theory of where the soul sits, you know, the whole like souls in your pineal gland. And even if you don't believe that, the reason that he came to that conclusion was because if you chop off your arm, you're not like an arm less in your soul. And it's like, you can even still feel your arm. You even had that phantom limb concept that people go through, right? That phenomena where like you still feel your fingers, or you get like a cramp in your leg that's no longer there. So he used that to explain that the soul doesn't live in your arm. If anything, it's got to live somewhere that if you chopped everything else off, it would still be there. And it would also have, for that reason, would have to be almost in like the central position. And that's where he pinpointed the pineal gland, because it's completely centered in the brain. So it can't necessarily live to like one, like the left side or the right side. But if Sally can chop her arm off and the arm can remain sentient, then she violates that whole concept of either having a soul in your arm. So either she does, or it means that she never had a soul to begin with, which seems more likely the case, which definitely means that she's a homunculus. So that's two homunculus confirmed in one movie.
Okay. And then we'll get to the toys soon, I guess. It'll be a while before we get to Toy Story 3, but I did recently rewatch that. And since we've been doing this podcast, I had forgotten that Mrs. Potato Head, since her eye is at Andy's house and they're a few miles away at the kindergarten, she can still see that eye still functions, and it's like quantumly entangled with her somehow. Yep. And, you know, watching it recently, I'm like, okay, that raises like 8 different questions at least.
Well, skipping ahead a little bit, because Toy Story 3, in all seriousness, was the first Disney movie that I saw on my own. And I don't mean like literally on my own, but I mean like, that as I was watching it, I remember thinking, this is programming. Like, this is nefarious programming. And it wasn't because I was like listening to conspiracy podcasts or anything. Like, I remember seeing it in the theater with my roommate, and my roommate brought his kids. So I tagged along. I was like, yeah, it's probably going to be a good movie because it's a freaking Disney multi-million-dollar budget movie. But there's this scene, and the whole premise of the movie is that like they're trying to save the toys from either being given away or being like ground up. Very Brave New Brave Little Toastery, right? Like it's almost the same beat for beat in a certain scene. You know what I'm talking about? It's like a big grinder, and there's like fire.
Yeah, it's an incinerator. I think we brought it up a bit in Brave Little Toaster.
And I remember thinking, we'll bring it up again when we go to the movie, but I remember thinking that this is nefarious because they're teaching kids right now that your toys that you've outgrown that probably deserve to get thrown away or given away, that they've got souls and that they will suffer and they'll die and you'll cause pain and anguish and grief to them if you throw them away or let them out of your sight or give them away. And how, I don't know, that just seems so incredibly nefarious to be drilling that in such a smart, like a strong level for these little tiny brains of like, no, truly your toys, not only are they alive, but they can feel pain and they're terrified that you might throw them out one day. I don't know. I think there's something nefarious about that.
Yeah. Well, that one in particular is considered the dark toy store, and people are like, oh, it's because they almost get incinerated. But then it's because of those feelings that the movie is creating, like you are saying, which makes it feel extra dark. So I think people understand that even if they're not saying it out loud, which makes it extremely effective if we're looking at it from a programming angle, I guess.
And if you believe like I do that Disney cares more about owning nostalgia and the price of nostalgia and investing in nostalgia more than necessarily the movies being breakout success left and right, because they can bank on it to just always exist. So you might say from like a business standpoint, it goes against the whole planned obsolescence thing. Like, yeah, of course we want you to throw out your old Woody so that you buy another one in 5 years, or like when you've got kids, so you don't want to like pass it around, but you also want it to be omnipresent. You just want that toy to always be around. And then now not only do you have dad's, you know, Woody, but you'll have your own, and then you'll get, you know, one for Buzz Lightyear for your kid, and maybe it just turns into like a whole legacy. I love what you're doing here.
For people that can't see, there's a continual Lotso there behind me, which I did save from a garbage bag once. I did buy it, but then they're house cleaning too much and tried to throw a Lotso Bear and the Cookie Monster. And like you're saying, I saw Toy Story 3. I couldn't let that happen. So nope. I did let a few toys get thrown away, though. Uh-oh! But not Lotso or the Cookie Monster. Or Dumbo. I think I saved Dumbo from the garbage as well. My wife got a little too ganky, too energetic with the house cleaning ones. So,
everything gets thrown out.
That's right. The Cookie Monster, I have a full-size Cookie Monster puppet, which I keep at work for obvious reasons because I'm a teacher, but I only bring him out so much. He's become legendary. Kids are always talking about the Cookie Monster, but I only actually bring him out once a month because I don't want them ripping him apart or something, because, you know, kids will try and rip off the Cookie Monster's eyes if you let them.
I kind of want to just thinking about it.
There's ping pong balls, though. They can be damaged, but yeah. Also, it's kind of, when you hear puppeteers complain, you know, in Muppet movies, and like, this is a hard job, just, you know, controlling that guy for 5 minutes and doing the voice. Yeah, your hand gets tired and your voice gets blown out. So I get it. I see why Frank Oz doesn't want to do this stuff anymore.
I imagine they just find people that smoke Newports exclusively to do the voice.
Yeah, the smoking and then getting on Sesame Street, that makes sense. I'm sure it's happened. I mean, the 70s probably.
I mean, it turns out they didn't have the greatest vetting process based on some of the stories.
Yeah, Elmo has a new voice now, doesn't he? And Puppeteer. How about let's roll back to the nightmare a bit, if you had any more strain threads to pull on. There's a good way to say it.
The only remaining one is really, there was just that interesting note that Sally is performing a very traditional role when it comes to occult practices. She is sort of the master of poison here. And she's also being kept away kind of like a homunculus would by her creator, right? Like when she disobeys, he locks her up. But she's also the one that's entrusted to making all of these different little concoctions. And that's, poison was kind of known as like, you know, the tool of like the ladies or something, or like the evil, you know, ladies evil.
And oh, that's again, like, my daughter's always trying to poison me. That's kind of a Adams Family thing. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, It's a very real sort of my girlfriend is trying to poison me constantly. So it's a very real thing. Just warning for everyone out there, too, that if you do have a significant other that's female, they're trying to poison you constantly. It's an eternal battle.
Oh, I eat what they leave for me when I come home at night. I must be filled with all the poisons by now. Dinner's always a surprise. Actually, it's not a surprise some nights. They sleep curry half of the week, which is fine because I like curry.
Well, and she, Sally, also serves as almost like the king's taster in a way, right? Because she has to taste the soup before she feeds it to her master. And that might be because she sees poison in there once in a while. But
yeah, I was about to say she poisons and tests it. She does both.
Yeah, often enough that she keeps a spare spoon in her sock just to trick her master from, you know, thinking that she's actually tasting the poison.
Do you think Sally's demeanor kind of did some societal programming, especially in the 90s? Like, especially like, you know, I don't think too many guys were like, I'm going to be like Jack Skellington. But I think a few girls were kind of like, oh, I want to be kind of a Sally.
I don't think there's any guy out there that's like, there probably are. Let me take that back. There's a bunch of weird, there's a bunch of weirdos out there. But like, yes, yeah, Sally is just a completely vacant doll, like a complete homunculus, no soul in a lot of ways, at least for me. I don't know. Maybe there's a lot of Sally simps out there, but yeah, she kind of gives off that Disney Project Monarch mind control vibe in a way, doesn't she?
Yeah, but then she does take a little more agency, I think. I mean, she actually goes about trying to fix things and save Santa. So she ends up
but she's a homunculus. How much agency does a homunculus have?
Well, that's my point. She goes out to do this little mission. She's got a pretty good plan that works 80% of the way until, you know, they're recaptured and almost, you know, dumped into a lava pit. But that takes some proactiveness, I guess, that you would not expect from a homunculus, to be sure.
And I don't know of many female homunculi either. So
do they have a sex?
They do. Yeah. Cause a homunculus means little man.
Oh, okay. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it's a fractal version of a man. So from what my understanding is that every homunculus has always been thought of as a man. And that there's not really like a female equivalent.
Well, maybe that's what we get with this movie then. So that's kind of exciting.
Well, yeah, Sally is one of the first female homunculi.
Yeah, but it's a different creation. You got to stitch her together. I mean, I guess you stitch the animal when you're making them. Okay. Yeah, sure.
That totally counts.
Haven't made my own yet. I know you have your own make it yourself kits too. Now, so.
Yeah, I mean, you're... Here's some of the magic powder that it comes with. I swear it's legal. But it clearly says do not inhale the dust or powder. And yeah, and if you do, you need to call like four or five different organizations. But yeah, that'll be coming out soon. So we're have a whole homunculus growers kit for people like you that don't know what the hell you're doing. You can now rely on the experts to kind of have like a little think of it as like a frozen meal, right? Like a TV dinner version of a homunculus. You want to go through and find your own cow uterus and have to like find the dung of some exotic animal that you have to dig up on a full moon. Like no one's got time for that in these busy days. So we've gone through all of that extra effort and put together the perfect kits guaranteed to grow a homunculus. And we'll come out with that soon. I don't know when we're going to drop it, but it'll be sometime in the first half of next year. And no, I'm not kidding. It sounds like a joke, but no, I'm not kidding.
No, he's not kidding. Yeah, everything I've heard about the creation, I'm like, man, I guess people of the past were like cooler with like, you know, putrid odors and farm smells and stuff. So because now
they saw putrescide as one of the key elements to life in this weird like way of like dichotomies, you know, like paradoxically the smell of death meant that something else could be living. I don't think that's true, but what they saw is that they would see like a cow starting to die, right? And then maggots would be born and you would get this smell, and they would equate that smell of putrescide to the life of the maggots, and they actually thought that the death created the life. No one really thought like a fly came and laid its eggs there and flew back away. It was like, oh my God, this dead flesh turned into new life. So that was some of the premise of all this.
Yeah. I guess that's where you got to put a little more scientific method. Watch it for a while. See what happens first. But that's
poke it with a stick. It's the original scientific process. Poke it with a stick. See what happens.
I think that's often still a scientific process.
They just charge a lot more for the stick now.
Yeah. Did you have any final thoughts on this one? Or maybe lots of thoughts. I don't know where you are.
It's legitimately a great movie. I think that it's weird that it's a Touchstone movie. So it has like a little asterisk, like, yeah, it's a Disney movie asterisk, the same way that Roger Rabbit is. But at this point, it made enough money that Disney fully graduated it into being like a normal Disney canon thing. Maybe Roger Rabbit just never made enough money for them to like fully embrace it evergreen.
And I didn't realize, probably because I haven't been in the States for years, but since 2010, they've been re-releasing this thing in 3D, and I guess using this as sort of a vehicle to try and up the technology every year. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you go a few years later, it's supposed to be a better 3D experience. They've just done the 30th anniversary, and I mean, I'm just going by what the wiki's saying here, but it's like, yeah, this is kind of causing a resurgence in 3D, which I don't know, it doesn't excite me that much because
we've been through so many of those resurgences at this point, right? Like,
yeah,
we're on like the fourth or fifth one of my lifetime at least.
But yeah, one of the reasons there is no sequel is I think around 2002, Disney was like, we should make a sequel. Burton's like, sure. CGI. No.
Yeah.
So
it would have
sort of thing.
And by the way, Frankenweenie that you mentioned is awesome. One of my favorite, like there's a cartoon version, but also a claymation, right? Or am I making that up?
I have it on Blu-ray right over here. I got it for $1 in the Blu-ray Apocalypse. Have not watched it yet. It is the 2012 one.
It is phenomenal. Seriously. Yeah. It is a really good
watch
movie.
Yeah, I definitely bought it, but I bought like 80 movies from the Blu-ray Apocalypse. So and then we're getting to that one anyway. So that's kind of like, that's the thing with doing podcasts like this. It's like, oh, I should really see that movie. Well, I'm going to see it in 2.5 years.
Yeah. I have to. Okay, we'll leave it for that.
Like I said, with Whiplash, like, I'll see it in like 2 years from now for sure. And Parasite, I'll finally watch Parasite like 2 years from now. But hey, that's a nice way to pace yourself, right? You don't want to do everything at once. That's one of the problems with modern pop media culture. It's like, here's 87 television shows you're supposed to watch so you can watch this one movie. It's like, no.
We're throwing shots at Marvel right now, which is also Disney.
Or Star Wars, which is also Disney. Yeah. I guess I'm throwing shots at Disney. Or Netflix. I mean, I don't know if I was talking to you. I've definitely seen on podcasts where I really like the new Fincher film, The Killer. And it barely gotten a release because it's like a Netflix thing. People are like, oh, that's not a real movie. It's like, no, it's a real movie. It's good.
I don't think that at all. I know I'm in a niche here, especially within like movie aficionados and cinemaphiles, but I hated the movie theater. I never like go to the movie theater. I like having a huge sound system where like the bass is as big as my house or like bigger than one of the rooms in my house. And I liked the huge screen. And I like the smell of the popcorn, but I'm a misanthrope and I don't like to be around other people. And I don't like not being able to pause it or go and just like make a stinky Lindberger and sardine, you know, I don't really do that, but in concept, right? Like go and do your own thing and like watch the movie in your own way. And I know that there's probably also directors and people that work on movies that are like cringing that it's like, no, you're supposed to sit in this little tiny box and stare at a screen for 2.5 hours and not move and no bathroom breaks and no making noise. But that's not how I've ever liked watching movies.
I get a win in Japan because they like to see movies during the day. So the late show, which is usually like 8 or 9, is cheaper. And I'll go and like, so I've had private screenings of movies basically. And maybe there's like 5 people in there.
It doesn't sound sustainable, man.
Well, everyone comes in the afternoon. So it's like going to a matinee, except it's nighttime. So anyway, I will give a plus up to the Killer, which I did not watch in a movie theater. I did watch that, you know, on my computer. But that's a good one. So it seems to have mixed reviews, and I'm on team positive for that one. But I'm on team positive for Nightmare Before Christmas. I'll admit 30 years ago, I was slightly underwhelmed. It helps to have, I think, more experience than a 14-year-old for this movie.
I don't want that smoke from the Hot Topic crowd. So I love this movie. I've always loved this movie. I will forever love this movie. Nightmare Before Christmas, Till the Day I Die. Go after Matt.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm assuming there's like a Taylor Swift. There's like a Swiftie movement behind Nightmare Before Christmas that you don't want to upset.
Yeah, probably. Anyway, I just watched it for the first time in 30 years and quite enjoyed it. I kind of thought I would like it when I saw it again. I just hadn't, gotten around to it. So
it's good. Not every song is an earworm. Some of the songs are like, it's like this didn't need to be a song. You could just be talking at this point.
This is Halloween playing for a month every year in Japan is enough of an earworm. I don't need more than that. Oh, just the last note I'll throw out is they were worried about Oogie Boogie coming across as racist. And I think actually let's see what it says here. They're basically, don't worry about it. I need to look at this specifically, I think, to get it right. Concerts, video games. Man, there's so much stuff on this. Okay, possible sequel. Here we go. Okay, Danny Elfman was worried that Oogie Boogie would be considered racist by the NAACP. The screenwriter thought so. Burton said she was being oversensitive. They got an African-American singer to do it. They actually did get caught out a little bit. It didn't kill the movie, but there was a bit of an issue for Oogie Boogie, apparently, being racist. I guess because it's all the voodoo-y stuff. He's like rapping a little bit. I don't really know what it was, to be honest. It was like the Minnie the Moocher Betty Boop cartoons. I think that was part of the explanation.
I got that, and it's not because I felt that way, but it was like, oh, this is the I've felt very much like this was out of place because a 2023 Disney movie might have done it slightly differently. But I was just like, coming hot off the heels of some of the previous movies, like the person with soul that sings jazz is always black, and in this case,
people
it's
pretty
like the
unhappy about
baddie.
Soul. I've heard What's lots that? Of people are. I haven't seen Soul, but I've heard several people have issues with that one.
Well, like it's racist. It's about a black guy.
Who I don't know what the was it that he dies and I don't know. I haven't seen the movie, so I was just hearing someone complaining about last week. I guess it's all is where I'm coming from, but forgot what the specific description was. what was that last? Oh, I was just gonna say, have you seen those Betty Boop cartoons? From the early 30s
those
are so. I mean, those are racist, but they're also like, they're not.
Well, they all were because
the
one that you're talking about, like the Max Fleischer early ones that had the Cab Calloway and stuff. If you look at Disney cartoons at the exact same time, guess what? They had the Mammies and they had the like the Guineas that were cooking. Everybody in like the big vat, like everyone was doing that. Bugs Bunny cartoons were doing the same thing. I remember growing up watching the reruns and it was like, they were all doing the Mickey Rooney routine. Every single cartoon was doing like the slanted eyes and the chopsticks as teeth.
But there you get footage of Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong actually performing in the early 30s, which is amazing.
And it's really good rotoscope too, is where you draw over each frame of something. It's one of the best examples of rotoscope. And in fact, I believe that in particular scene, the Cab Calloway and the Betty Boop, that one is what inspired Cuphead, or one of the many ones that inspired Cuphead.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the imagination there, you have to put lots of butts on it, but it's still just amazingly imaginative, for within the weird constraints of the time.
It was very creatively racist. It wasn't just regular racist. Like, there was a lot of flair to it.
I guess that's why Oogie Boogie kind of, you can draw a line to it, because if those earlier cartoons didn't exist, I don't think anyone would ever have that feeling. It's like the earlier media informed the later media,
When do you think Disney's going to remake Birth of a Nation in CGI?
It'll be a plus on streaming and no one will see it.
Sounds more like a Daily Wire sort of thing where they're like, Disney wouldn't do this, but we will.
It actually came out a year ago. You just don't know about it. It came out in 2021. Yeah.
This is random, but just to wrap it up, have you seen the Atlas Shrugged movies?
Have I even read the book? No, I haven't, but...
That's another fever dream in itself.
I'm sure. You know, fever dream of movies. Those seem like books you can't easily adapt. And they were made... that was like 10 years ago, isn't it? It was a while ago.
Maybe more than 10 years. Yeah, the first one was done with a very high budget. And it didn't do very well. And then the second one, they like really had to finish the story. Was there even three? I don't remember if there was three, but it's like a long, like if you watched them all back to back, it's like a 7-hour experience. And there's an immediate drop in quality after the first movie where they recast everyone and everything's like green screen and CGI instead. But there's a very real sunken cost fallacy feeling where you're like, well, I saw the first one, like, and I watched that 3 hours, so I kind of have to watch this other 3 hours.
Okay, I don't know if you're selling me on that one.
No, I'm not a salesman, but if you do Paranoid 15, if you put that code in, it'll play 15% faster, so it'll be over a little bit sooner.
I guess we'll wrap up for today if you want to give a bit more on your code there.
Yeah, chaostwins.com, still the big thing. The campaign ended. It's fully funded. It's shipping in January. But even if you're listening to this now or in the future, even if this is like in the year 2030, you should be able to still go to chaostwins.com and grab a copy. And hopefully if it is 2030, you'll grab all six, plus the movie, plus the Neuralink branded Chaos Twins that you plug in through your eye.
All right. As for me, I do a lot of media-esque podcasts on Patreon. We're Podcastio Podcastius. I'll try and micro machine it. There's a Twilight Zone Time Enough podcast. There's really good movies, really bad movies on Films and Filthuses and KO Podcasting. This one's a call at Disney. We talk about Space 1999 on Podcast 1999. And some of my friends do video game stuff. There's Luke Loves Pokemon, Hyrule Field Report about Zelda games, and the Game Show where gamers game each other about the games. Okay, there we go. I'm trying to make it so if people really want to hit the plus 30, it like times out right, you know? if you listen every week, maybe you don't need to hear the plug every time. So, but hey, if you're here for the first time, welcome too, because this is a big movie. People might show up for the night before Christmas. Okay, so what are you going to do for this Christmas? I'm going to go to work. It's usually my day off. But we're working on Christmas. That's Japan.
Well, I got laid off recently, so I'm kicking back and just I'm doing a little me time for Christmas.
Okay, that sounds good too, because I'm going to have kids screaming at me for Christmas, which I guess that is the Christmas experience. So
yeah, it's a Christmas. That's why you have to give them presents. It's the real Halloween. It's the real trick or treat.
They're going to ask for presents too.
Imagine not giving your kids presents on Christmas. If you really want to know what trick or treat was all about, I feel like that would be a better example.
Mm,